Attorney General Schneider.
May it please the court. Vivian Wickren, Assistant Attorney General, on behalf of the defendants appellants Donald Snyder, Michael Holmes, and Mark Harris. This is an appeal from the denial of summary judgment based on qualified immunity. The plaintiffs are 27 of some 141 sexually dangerous persons in the custody of the Department of Corrections and now housed at Big Muddy River Correctional Center. The plaintiffs sued the defendants for violations of their 14th Amendment substantive due process rights. Relevant to this appeal, the plaintiffs claim first that they are entitled to be housed in a least restrictive environment, which they claim means that they're entitled to be housed in a facility separate from a prison, to not have time.
Let me ask you, Ms. Wickren, how this state's program works. People seem to get into this before they have been convicted.
Generally speaking, do they have the right to opt out?
That is, if the state or the judge says, "Why don't you go into this form of civil commitment?" Can they say, "No, skip that, put me on trial"?
No, Your Honor. That's within the discretion of the state's attorney who decides whether to pursue the civil commitment.
So we have to view this as completely involuntary on the part of the plaintiffs.
Correct.
Are these usually people who are released from prison for sex offenses and then are detained?
That you might be referring to what occurs under the Sexually Violent Persons Act, in which after the person has served their sentence, they can be civilly committed beyond. These people may have, some of them, been convicted of sexual assault or abuse in the past, but that is not dependent or have anything necessarily to do with whether they're civilly committed.
Some kind of an independent act that exposes them to this?
Yes, it could be. As part of the prosecution, the state's attorney has to show acts of sexual abuse and assault in addition to the person having a mental disability for at least a year and a propensity to commit these types of crimes.
This is triggered by the existence of a mental disability then. I mean, there has to be some expert opinion as to that.
Yes.
And is it initiated by the state's attorney?
Correct. So it could be premised on a specific act that the state's attorney decides to bring such a case, or on a series of acts for which the person is committed and the state's attorney decides that treatment for the person is the best possible route. Returning to what the plaintiffs are suing for.
Let me interrupt you again, if I might. Is Big Muddy the only place where these people are certified?
Correct. Currently in Illinois, the sexually dangerous persons are only housed at Big Muddy.
Is there a Small Muddy?
Not that I'm aware of. I don't know if there's a Small Muddy River even. The plaintiffs also claim that they're entitled to be solved individually. Their second claim is that they should not be required as conditions to their treatment to disclose past sexual offenses, submit to a polygraph examination to verify their disclosures, and to sign.
Could they be prosecuted for if they admit to certain past sexual offenses?
There's the possibility that if...
By the use of that particular admission.
If required by Illinois law to report to law enforcement a disclosure that is made, it's always a possibility. There's no evidence here that any of the plaintiffs, let alone the other 100 and something sexually dangerous persons, disclosures have been used against them for further criminal prosecution or to prolong their civil commitment in any way. Which in McCoon, the Supreme Court noted that there was no evidence there that these types of disclosures have been used as a filtering system for further prosecution, and the same in this case. There's no evidence of that. The third claim that the plaintiffs bring is in reference to the adequacy of the treatment. They asked for individual treatment as the primary mode of their therapy, as opposed to the group therapy that is currently used at Big Muddy in the Sexually Dangerous Persons Program. The defendants asked that this court reverse the denial of qualified immunity. Qualified immunity shields the defendants from damages from civil liability damages if they did not violate their rights and the law was not clearly established at the relevant time. The plaintiffs did not meet their burden on either of these elements. The contours of the rights here are not clearly defined in the law, such that a reasonable government official would have known that these decisions that were made would violate their constitutional rights.
How would you describe the treatment of these people versus regular convicted prisoners?
All of the civilly committed persons and the inmates are in a high medium security facility at Big Muddy. The sexually dangerous persons only have contact with the inmates in what's known as the common areas of the prison, such as in the dining room, in the library, on their job assignments. They are only housed with other sexually dangerous persons as cellmates, although some of them are on the same wing as other inmates. They're not directly housed with them.
Is that because they just committed some sort of a violent act? In addition to being a sexual offender?
Generally, those sexually dangerous persons who are not participating in treatment for some reason are housed on the wing that also houses some inmates.
This is usually in treatment that they opt out of for whatever reason?
There's people who have decided not to pursue the treatment for various reasons, including the conditions that the plaintiffs point to. They don't want to sign the waiver form. They don't think treatment will help them. So there's a variety of reasons.
Does that take them out of the program altogether?
Yes. The conditions are just that. If you don't sign the form and agree to talk about your past behavior, then you cannot participate in the group therapy session. Furthermore,
being in the same wing, then that could just mean what is the distinction between these people and the regular incarcerated prisoners?
The rules of the facility do apply to the sexually dangerous persons, although they're not treated disciplinarily the same as other inmates. For instance, since they do not earn good conduct credit, they cannot have that taken away.
Well, that's the negative, actually, isn't it? They can't earn their way out of there. So they get a lesser, I guess it's a distinction.
Right. Well, the key to their release is petitioning the court. And that can happen as soon as they petition. There's no set amount of time before they can start asking the court to release them.
They can be released when they're, in effect, have attained a certain...
The court has to find that they've recovered from their mental disability, yes. In which they would have to put on their case and show the court how they went about fulfilling that. Also, they cannot be transferred to another facility because Big Muddy River is the only facility that currently houses the sexually dangerous persons. And again, their release is dependent on their petitioning the court and the court agreeing to that. Just because they're housed in a prison facility, they're kept separately as far as their housing from other inmates, and the fact that they're subject to rules of the facility does not necessarily turn their confinement into punishment. Other civil commitment institutions also have rules that people must follow and consequences for not following those rules. For instance, there's evidence not relevant to the issues here about attacks on one sexually dangerous person to another. Obviously, if such an attack takes place, there has to be consequences for those actions. So the rules and consequences do apply to the civil committees as well.
Is Big Muddy, what about persons convicted of sexual offenses criminally?
Correct. Those people are also housed at Big Muddy. In fact, I think the record reflects that that's the majority of the people housed at that facility.
Sex offenders.
Correct. There's a separate program for inmates who are criminally convicted, a sexually dangerous violent person program that is separate from this program. But it's a very big program at the facility.
So this is a big money. They have the, what do you call them, psychiatric or some sort of mental problem that they work with, that they have specialists at that prison to deal with these people?
Yes.
And so that's why they're criminals as well as civil commitments.
Correct. Even if this court finds that the conditions at Big Muddy River are punitive such that it violates the 14th Amendment and the plaintiff's rights, the law in this area is very unclear. There are virtually no cases that discuss exactly what conditions are considered such that they are punishment. There's a few cases that talk about transferring someone and restraining them and whether that's punishment. But while courts generally state that civil committees are entitled to more considerate treatment, there's no fleshing out of what exactly that treatment is and what would constitute a violation of the Constitution, what types of conditions that would be. The plaintiffs point to Youngberg and Allen for the general proposition, again, that they're entitled to more considerate treatment, but there's no guidance as to what exactly those conditions might be. Turning to the second issue that is raised.
Does Illinois have a sex offender reporting statute? Are these people required to register?
My understanding is that only once something is reported to the Department of Family and Children's Services that they determine who is put on the central registry. So it would have to be a report, and that report would have to be indicated.
Don't you have to be convicted first?
There are two ways that you can be put on it. One is through the Department of Children and Family Services, which has an administrative process by which it's determined whether you are dangerous sexually to children. And then there's a separate one.
Absent a conviction.
Correct. If you are convicted of assault or abuse of child or adult, that's another way to get onto the central registry. As far as the conditions to the treatment program, the plaintiffs have not shown that that violates their 14th Amendment rights. The waiver form that the plaintiffs are required to sign is intended not as punishment, but to inform the person that some of the information that may be disclosed will have to be reported to law enforcement authorities. These types of forms are used in programs throughout the nation. The Supreme Court discussed the use of this type of form in McCoon and found that it did not violate the person's Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination. The requirement that sexually dangerous persons disclose past behaviors or submit to a polygraph also serves legitimate treatment purposes in that in order to recover and be released at the soonest possible time, it's generally believed that disclosing what you've done and understanding why you have chosen to do those things is a step in the recovery process of the person.
But that's the preliminary step, and that's
correct.
Sort of the entry fee. If they don't agree to that, then they don't get treatment.
Correct. And the Supreme Court discussed the implications of this and balancing the person's liberty interest and their interest against self-incrimination versus the interest of society and protecting society from sexually dangerous persons. And struck the balance in favor of allowing these types of disclosures and forms and polygraphs to be used in the context of the Fifth Amendment. The plaintiffs presume that engaging in treatment reduces the amount of time that the person spends in civil commitment, and that's a reasonable presumption. But there has been no evidence presented that any of these plaintiffs would have been released sooner or could have if they had been permitted to participate in treatment. Also, McCoon discusses whether giving someone immunity is required and also discusses whether the program is being used as a funnel, as I mentioned earlier, for prosecuting or maintaining the person within the system longer.
I guess that means that there's no evidence that the program works.
Well,
if there's no difference in who gets out.
Right. There was evidence that two of the persons who did not regularly participate were released. there, if you search the cases in this area, there people have been released from the institution, state cases, people versus, and they discuss, you know, the process that the person went through. I would like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Whitney.
May it please the court, my name is Richard Whitney, representing the plaintiffs, appellees in this case. Your Honors, ever since Youngberg v. Romeo, it has been well established in the law that due process under the 14th Amendment forbids the state from imposing a punitive regimen on civilly committed persons. And that is the central issue in this case. Contrary to what has been asserted in oral argument here today, the first claim of the plaintiffs is not simply that they have a right to be celled individually. The larger part of the first claim is that they have a right to be placed in the least restrictive environment consistent with the purposes of their civil commitment, as directed by Youngberg v. Romeo, and for that matter, the statute under which they're committed.
If your claim arises under the statute, you're in the wrong court.
We bring this under the Constitution. The statute, the only reason the statute enters into this at all is simply to instruct. The statute is intended to tailor the Constitution, but this is not about challenging the statute itself, but challenging...
No, but claims under the statute, you're in the wrong court. The Supreme Court held in Pennhurst against Haldeman that a federal court can't tell state officials to comply with state law, even under the supplemental jurisdiction.
Correct. We're not... This claim is brought under the substantive component of the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment and nothing else. But under that clause, civilly committed persons have certain rights, including the right not to be treated in the same manner as person...
Isn't this sort of a hybrid commitment, though? It's not as opposed to a regular mental health commitment. This is a little different, because aren't they all facing prosecution initially?
It is different in that one respect, yes.
Well, I mean, that's,
it makes them pretrial detainees. And we know from Bell against Wolfish that there's no problem with holding pretrial detainees in regular prisons, putting them in regular cells, and subjecting them to regular prison regimen.
But they still cannot be treated the same as...
They can't be punished, right? That was correct. The holding in both Youngberg and in Bell, but the Supreme Court held in Bell that the no punishment principle was perfectly compatible with putting people in regular prisons. Now, obviously, the Wolfish in Bell against Wolfish didn't agree with that, and the reason why it's Bell against Wolfish is because the Second Circuit hadn't agreed with that proposition. But the Supreme Court did, and I don't see how your position is compatible with Bell against Wolfish.
Because these are civilly committed detainees after the period of civil commitment, other rules of law apply, including the admonitions from the Supreme Court in Youngberg v. Romeo and in Allen v. Illinois. And indeed, the central issue on this appeal is whether officials of the Department of Corrections can do exactly what the Supreme Court in Allen warned them they should not do, and then seek refuge in qualified immunity, claiming that they had no warnings that their conduct was unconstitutional.
If this were in a place, let's just say Big Muddy, did not include the criminals, but had all the same rules, all the same conditions, and the same whatever else goes on there, it seems to me the big problem here is the commingling with even at meals and perhaps in the yard or wherever else with the criminals who are pretty mean to these people. That seems to be the only thing that would be caustic as far as everybody's got to have rules and they're going to be, everybody's got to eat. There are going to be lots of things that are the same as in a prison. If the criminals weren't there, would this be a problem?
Certainly that is one important component, as the Supreme Court pointed out in Kansas v. Hendricks, one of the criteria for determining what is punitive and what is not punitive is that civilly confined persons be segregated from the general prison population. However, I don't think that's the only important component. Part of it is the fact that they are subjected, as opposing counsel essentially conceded, to exactly the same rules and regulations, with the one exception that they can't lose their good time, which they
are. But is there something wrong with those rules? That's what I'm saying.
Yes, they're designed for prisoners. They're designed to be retributive and perform the retributive function of the prison system. For example,
how do we separate the rules that are retributive or punitive from the rules that are necessary just for security? That is, to make sure people don't escape and don't harm each other.
Some of the rules and regulations are expressly designed for a retributive purpose.
Well, how do we identify them?
I think we can identify them by looking at the rules that are actually been applied. For example, the inmate orientation manual, I believe, is attached as an exhibit to the Holmes deposition, document 194, exhibit B. And it identifies a number of rules that clearly do not invoke any legitimate security purpose. For example, an inmate cannot receive a self-addressed stamped envelope in a mailing that comes in to the prison. What conceivable security purpose could there be to not be able to receive a stamp from someone on the outside? Or they can't receive a poster, or they can't receive blank greeting cards. Things like this that are...
Many prisons have rules that you can't receive greeting cards or indeed any other printed or similar matter except direct from a publisher. And the idea, if I understand it, is to prevent the smuggling of contraband, which one can include within the cover of a book. You slice it open and stick something in. You could do that in a greeting card, too. And I could understand rules like this having security functions.
Well, Your Honor, I would agree with you that there are legitimate security functions that suggest that it is appropriate for any place of confinement to be able to monitor mail, but they have that right. These rules go to what the prisoner can actually possess. They serve no conceivable therapeutic purpose.
Let me ask a different question about the being in the same place with other convicted inmates. Are there any data about the risks that these plaintiffs face from other inmates compared to the risk that they face from the detainees, other detainees?
I know of no empirical data as such. However, and we do cite this in the brief, the appendix to the Ture case that is cited, they reproduced the standards of the Association for Treatment of Sex Offenders. And there, one of the professional standards recommended is that habitual sex offenders who are being civilly committed be placed in a non-punitive environment. So the professional association, the recognized national professional association that sets the standards for this kind of treatment has said that they should not be kept in a punitive environment.
There's no, doesn't give us any help in figuring out whether a particular environment is punitive. The Supreme Court has said they can't be punished. If there are no data, for example, on relative risks, how would we figure out whether holding them with other prisoners was punitive?
Your Honor,
I hope it's clear. I'm starting from Bellion's Wolfish, which says you can keep them in places designed for security, even though they don't like the conditions. Then we have to figure out whether there's some tenable line between security and punishment. Data on relative riskiness of the environment might be a line. Right. Is there any other line that we can get a handle on?
I think the commingling does establish one of those lines. There's no evidence that there is any empirical...
Look, the reason I'm asking this is that argument was rejected as a per se rule in Bell against Wolfish. Supreme Court held that it is not punishment for the pretrial detainees to be commingled with convicted persons in regular prisons. Now, if there's some data or some other way of getting a handle on why it would be different for your plaintiffs, we could get someplace. But as a per se rule, you just run smack into Bell against Wolfage.
But the distinction between the cases, the line of cases starting from Youngberg through Allen through Hendricks, is these are persons who are civilly committed for the express purpose of receiving treatment, unlike the pretrial detainees in Bell v. Wolfage.
What happens if they flunk out of the program?
Well, there have, in fact, been many cases that they don't flunk out per se. They can continue to receive the treatment once they pass the hurdles, which we object to in the second issue involved here. But there is no flunking out. They can continue the treatment indefinitely.
Well, let me ask you another way. How long is the commitment?
The commitment can be indefinite until they bring a petition that passes muster in the state court showing that they are fit to be returned.
So there is no commitment for a period of years. It's until they are cured or at least...
whether it's hopeless?
Yes.
What? I mean, surely they can't be held longer than the maximum penalty for the crime that got them into this problem.
Well, as with other civil commitment, there are the cases where people can be civilly committed indefinitely if they're not, you know, under mental health code, of course, or they pose a danger.
They're currently dangerous to others.
Correct. And I think it's a similar standard here. They have to prove under the statute that they are fit to be released into general society.
That's my question. After the maximum penalty for the crime of which you're accused is run, surely they don't have to prove anything. The state would have to prove that they are, at that moment, dangerous to others.
They still have to take the initiative to bring the petition to gain their release. There is no other way out. And that brings us to the importance of the second and third issues on this appeal, regarding the caliber of the treatment that they're being afforded and the barriers to treatment that have been erected, including the need to compromise their right against self-incrimination. Now, opposing counsel has said that while there's no evidence that any of this information that's been divulged thus far has been used in any prosecution, but it's the fear of that possible prosecution and the fact that they have to pass those hurdles that I think raises a constitutional question here, because they are constitutionally entitled to treatment. That is the purpose of their civil commitment, and to erect these barriers, including the barrier of having to take a polygraph test, which is universally disfavored in law as being used as a tool for decision making.
If they flunk the polygraph, they don't get to take the program?
They are required to submit to polygraph tests.
They don't have to pass it, do they?
I think it's implied
I can see where that's a veiled threat, where someone's going to be afraid, well, gee, if I don't tell them that I did this, that, and the other thing, then I'm going to flunk. But likely they're not going to say very much, so they go in and say, no, I never did this, that, or the other thing, and it doesn't work on the polygraph. But aren't they... Okay, now they did all this. They injected themselves to it.
The director of the mental health program could conclude from the failure of the polygraph test that the civilly committed person is not being honest.
So they do use it then?
And yes.
Okay, that's a key question, because obviously subjecting to and passing is a different standard.
The director of mental health services, Carriage, has the discretion as to who is admitted and who is not. Mm-hmm. And they can use that as a tool. But I would submit that it's the threat of this barrier that they have to take the polygraph test and that they have to compromise the right against self-incrimination that poses a very daunting barrier to receiving the mentally health treatment to which they are entitled under the Constitution, because that is the purpose of their civil commitment. And again, that gets us back to the other question that I think concerns Judge Easterbrook here, about distinguishing this from Bell v. Wolfish, and that is that they are entitled to receive the treatment. That is the purpose of their civil commitment, and as a result of that, we have clear guidance in the cases of Allen and Kansas v. Hendricks as
but
to...
All you get from Youngberg is that kind of treatment that, in the professional judgment of the staff, seems sensible. Your argument seems to be that the professional judgment of the staff should be overridden, that the kind of treatment that we plaintiffs know is best is individual rather than group, and so on. And there's a big gap between Youngberg's holding that plaintiffs are entitled to professional judgment about treatment and your claim that you're entitled to damages because you don't like their professional judgment about treatment.
Your Honor, I see that my time has expired. May I respond?
Certainly.
What Youngberg also held is that the decisions must be made by a professional with appropriate training. It's not simply that we don't like the type of training that Mr. Karich has provided. As we argue at some length in our brief, his own testimony at deposition made very clear that he was not a professional suitable for directing the program for sexually dangerous persons. He had a master's degree in education. He had very little counseling background before he was appointed the job. The program, in some respects, is contrary to ATSA standards. He could not present empirical or scientific basis for most of his recovery criteria. And the program is a one-size-fits-all group therapy for everyone, regardless of the individual mental illness or affliction that caused the person to be there in the first place. He did not even have his license to be a counselor until October of 2001. And this was the man serving as the director for the entire program. Clearly that does not meet the professional standards that set forth in Youngberg, and I'm referring to the Youngberg opinion note 30.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Anything further? That talk fast. You have about 45 seconds.
Okay. Just to clarify, persons who are civilly committed for indefinite term, part of it is showing that they have a mental disability. So in order to be released, they must show that mental disability they've recovered from that mental disability.
I think you're in deep trouble if you take that position under Fouchier against Louisiana.
That's how the standard is written, so.
We don't have a Fouchier claim here.
Also, as far as the treatment goes, the Youngberg professional judgment standard is a very broad standard, as the Supreme Court has laid it out in footnote 30 of Youngberg. It explains that that's anyone who's qualified, who has education in
Justice
any
Douglas once said that no footnote in the Supreme Court can ever be deemed to establish any law.
Well,
he said that in a footnote.
Hopefully this court finds that if there was constitutional violation, the law was not clearly established. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.